landmasses come together, straining and shoving until either mountains rise between them, or one is subsumed by the other in a breaking of earth and a shattering of stone.
"We could see MacDhu thinking," Kenny said, "but he's no the man to be telling anyone what's in his mind, aye?"
"Almost no one," Roger thought suddenly, with the memory of Fraser's voice so low as barely to be heard beneath the whining autumn wind.
"He told me."
The thought was a small, sudden warmth in his chest, but he pushed it aside, not to be distracted.
"So, one evening MacDhu came back to us quite late," Kenny said, "but instead of lying down to his rest, he came and summoned us, me and my brothers, Gavin Hayes, Ronnie Sinclair, and Tom Christie."
Fraser had roused the six men quietly from their sleep and brought them to one of the cell's few windows where the light of the night sky might shine upon his face. The men had gathered round him, heavy-eyed and aching from the day's labours, wondering what this might mean. Since the last small clash, a fight between two men over a meaningless insult, Christie and Fraser hadn't exchanged a word, but had kept each man to himself. It was a soft spring night, the air still crisp, but smelling of fresh green things from the sprouting moor and the salt scent of the distant sea. A night to make a man yearn to run free upon the earth and feel the blood humming dark in his veins. Tired or not, the men roused to it, alive and alert. Christie was alert, wary-eyed and watchful. Here he was, called face to face with Fraser and five of his closest allies. What might they intend? True, they stood in a cell with 50 men sleeping round them, and some of those would come to Christie's aid if he called. But a man could be beaten or killed before anyone knew he was threatened. Fraser had spoken not a word to start, but smiled and put out his hand to Tom Christie. The other man had hesitated for a moment, suspicious, but there was no choice after all.
"You would have thought MacDhu held a bolt of lightning in his hand, the way the shock of it went through Christie."
Kenny's own hand lay open on the table between them, the palm hard as horn with calluses. The short, thick fingers curled slowly closed, and Kenny shook his head, a broad grin creasing his face.
"I dinna ken how it was MacDhu found out that Christie was a Freemason, but he knew it. You should have seen the look on Tom's face when he realised that Jamie Roy was one besides." "It was Quarry did it," Kenny explained, seeing the question still on Roger's face. "He was a master himself, see?"
A master mason, that was, and head of a small military lodge composed of the officers of the garrison. One of their members had died recently, though, leaving them one man short of the required seven. Quarry had considered the situation, and after some cautiously exploratory conversation on the matter, invited Fraser to join them. A gentleman was a gentleman after all, Jacobite or no. Not precisely an orthodox situation, Roger thought, but this Quarry sounded the type to adjust regulations to suit himself. For that matter, so was Fraser.
"So Quarry made him, and he moved from apprentice to fellow craft in a month's time, and was a master himself a month after that. And that was when he chose to tell us of it. And so we founded a new lodge that night, the seven of us. Ardsmuir Lodge number 2.
Roger snorted in wry amusement, seeing it.
"Aye, you six, and Christie."
Tom Christie, the Protestant. And Christie, stiff-necked but honourable, sworn to the Mason's oaths, would have had no choice but been obliged to accept Fraser and his Catholics as brethren.
"To start with, within 3 months, though, every man in the cells was made apprentice, and there wasn't so much trouble after that."
"There wouldn't have been. Freemasons held as basic principles the notions of equality. Gentleman, crofter, fisherman, laird. Such distinctions were not taken account of in a lodge. And tolerance. No discussion of politics or religion among the brothers. That was the rule."
"I can't think it did Jamie any harm to belong to the officer's lodge either," Roger said.
"Ooh,
said Kenny, rather vaguely. "No, I didn't suppose I did." He pushed back his stool and made to rise. The story was done, the dark had come, and it was time to light a candle. He made no move toward the clay candlestick that stood on the hearth, but Roger glanced toward the glow of the banked fire and noticed for the first time that there was no smell of cooking food.
"It's time I was away home for supper," he said, rising himself. "Come with me, aye?"
Kenny brightened noticeably.
"I will then, Asmiorich, and thanks. Give me a moment to milk the goats, and I'll be right along."
When I came back upstairs next morning after a delicious breakfast featuring omelettes made with minced buffalo meat, sweet onions and mushrooms, I found Jamie awake, though not noticeably bright-eyed. "How are you this morning?" I asked, setting down the tray I had brought him and putting a hand on his forehead. Still warm, but no longer blazing. The fever was nearly gone.
"I wish I were dead, if only so folk would stop asking how I am," he replied grumpily.
I took his mood as an indicator of returning health and took my hand away. "Have you used the chamber pot yet this morning?" He raised one eyebrow, glowering.
"Have you?"
"You know, you are perfectly impossible when you don't feel well," I remarked, rising to peer into the crudely glazed pot for myself. Nothing.
"Does it not occur to you, Sassenach, that perhaps it's yourself that's impossible when I'm ill? If you're not feeding me some disgusting substance made of ground beetles and hoof shavings, you're poking my belly and making intimate inquiries into the state of my bowels. Ah!"
I had, in fact, pulled down the sheet and prodded him in the lower abdomen. No distension from a swollen bladder. His exclamation appeared to be due entirely to ticklishness. I quickly palpated the liver, but found no hardness. That was a relief. "Have you a pain in your back?"
"I've a marked pain in my backside," he said,
narrowing one eye at me and folding his arms protectively across his middle.
"And it's getting worse by the moment."
"I'm trying to determine whether the snake venom has affected your kidneys," I explained patiently, deciding to overlook this last remark. "If you can't piss..."
"I can do that fine,"
he assured me, pulling the sheet up to his chest, lest I demand proof.
"Now, just leave me to my breakfast and I'll..."
"How do you know? You haven't."
"I have."
Seeing my sceptical glance at the chamber pot, he glowered under his brows and muttered something ending in...
"window."
I swung round to the open window, shutters open, and sash raised in spite of the chilly morning air. "You did what?"
"Well," he defended himself, "I was standing up, and I just thought I would, that's all."
"Why were you standing up?"
"Oh, I thought I would."
He blinked at me, innocent as a day-old child. I left the question, going on to more important matters. "Was there blood in..."
"What have you brought me for my breakfast?"
Ignoring my clinical inquiries, he rolled to one side and lifted the napkin draped over the tray. He looked at the bowl of bread and milk thus revealed, then turned his head, giving me a look of the most profound betrayal. Before he could start in on further grievances, I forestalled him by sitting down on the stool beside him and demanding bluntly, "What's wrong with Tom Christie?" He blinked, taken by surprise.
"Is something amiss with the man?"
"I wouldn't know. I haven't seen him."
"Well, I haven't seen him in more than 20 years myself," he said,
picking up the spoon and prodding the bread and milk suspiciously.
"If he's grown a spare head in that time, it's news to me."
"Ho," I said tolerantly. "You may, and I say may, possibly have fooled Roger, but I know you." He looked up at that and gave me a sidelong smile.
"Oh, aye. Do you know, I dinna care much for bread and milk."
My heart fluttered at sight of that smile, but I maintained my dignity. "If you're thinking of blackmailing me into bringing you a steak, you can forget it," I advised him. "I can wait to find out about Tom Christie, if I have to." I stood up, shaking out my skirts as though to leave, and turned toward the door.
"Make it porridge with honey and I'll tell you."
I turned round to find him grinning at me. "Done," I said, and came back to the stool. He considered for a moment, but I could see that he was only deciding how and where to begin. "Roger told me about the Masonic Lodge at Ardsmuir," I said, to help out, "last night." Jamie shot me a startled look.
"And where did wee Roger Mac find that out? Did Christie tell him?"
"No, Kenny Lindsay did. But evidently Christie gave Roger a Masonic sign of some sort when he arrived. I thought Catholics weren't allowed to be Masons, actually." He raised one eyebrow.
"Aye, well, the Pope wasn't in Ardsmuir prison, and I was. Though I haven't heard that it's forbidden forby. So wee Roger's a Freemason too, is he?"
"Apparently. And perhaps it isn't forbidden now. It will be later." I flapped a hand, dismissing it. "There's something else about Christie, though, isn't there?" He nodded and glanced away.
"Aye, there is," he said quietly. "Do you recall a Sergeant Murchison, Sassenach?"
"Vividly." I had met the sergeant only once, more than 2 years previously in Cross Creek. The name seemed familiar in some other, more recent context, though. Then I recalled where I had heard it. Archie Hayes mentioned him. Or them. That was it. There were two of them, twins. One of them was the man who shot Archie at Culloden, wasn't he? Jamie nodded. His eyes were hooded, and I could see that he was looking back into the time he had spent in Ardsmuir.
"Aye, and to shoot a lad in cold blood was nae more than one could expect from either of them. A crueler pair I hope never to meet."
The corner of his mouth turned up, but without humour.
"The only thing I ken to Stephen Bonnet's credit is that he killed one of yon Lurdens."
"And the other?" I asked.
"I killed the other."
The room seemed suddenly very quiet, as though the two of us were far removed from Fraser's Ridge, alone together, that bald statement floating in the air between us. He was looking straight at me, blue eyes guarded, waiting to see what I would say. I swallowed.
"Why?"
I asked, vaguely surprised at the calmness of my own voice. He did look away then, shaking his head.
"A 100 reasons," he said softly. "And none."
He rubbed absently at his wrist as though feeling the weight of iron fetters.
"I could tell you stories of their viciousness, Sassenach, and they would be true. They preyed upon the weak, robbing and beating, and they were the sort who took delight in cruelty for its own sake. There's no recourse against such men, not in a prison. But I dinna see so as an excuse, for there is none."
The prisoners at Ardsmuir were used for labour, cutting peats, quarrying and hauling stone. They worked in small groups, each group guarded by an English soldier armed with musket and club. The musket, to prevent escape, the club, to enforce orders and ensure submission.
"That was summer. You'll ken the summer in the Highlands, Sassenach. The summer dim."
I nodded. The summer dim was the light of the Highland night, late in summer. So far to the north, the sun barely set on Midsummer's Eve. It would disappear below the horizon, but even at midnight the sky was pale and milky white, and the air wasn't dark, but seemed filled with unearthly mist. The prison governor took advantage of the light now and then to work the prisoners into the late hours of the evening.
"We didn't mind so much," Jamie said.
His eyes were open, but fixed on whatever he was seeing in the summer dim of memory.
"It was better to be outside than in. And yet, by the evening, we'd be so drookit with fatigue that we could barely set one foot before the other. It was like walking in a dream."
Both guards and men were numb with exhaustion by the time the work of the day was done. The groups of prisoners were collected, formed up into a column, and marched back toward the prison, shuffling across the moorland, stumbling and nodding, drunk with the need to fall down and sleep.
"We were still by the quarry when they set off. We were to load the wagon with the stone-cutting tools and the last of the blocks, and follow. I remember I heaved a great block up into the wagon bed and stood back, panting with the effort. There was a sound behind me, and I turned to see Sergeant Murchison. Billy it was, though I didn't find that out till later.
The sergeant was no more than a squat black shape in the dim, face invisible against the sky, the colour of an oyster's shell.
I wondered, now and then, if I wouldn't have done it had I seen his face.
The fingers of Jamie's left hand stroked his wrist absently, and I realised that he still felt the weight of the irons he had worn. The sergeant had raised his club, poked Jamie hard in the ribs, then used it to point to a maul left lying on the ground. Then the sergeant turned away.
"I didn't think about it for a moment," Jamie said softly. "I was on him in two steps with the chain of my fetters hard against his throat. He hadn't time to make a sound."
The wagon stood no more than 10 feet from the lip of the quarry pool. There was a drop of 40 feet straight down, and the water below, 100 feet deep, black and waveless under that hollow white sky.
I tied him to one of the blocks and threw him over, and then I went back to the wagon. The two men from my group were there, standing like statues in the dim, watching. They said nothing, nor did I. I stepped up and took the reins. They got into the back of the wagon, and I drove toward the prison. We caught up to the column before too long, and all went back together without a word. No one missed Sergeant Murchison till the next evening, for they thought he was down in the village off duty. I dinna think they ever found him.
He seemed to notice what he was doing then, and took his hand away from his wrist. "And the two men?" I asked softly. He nodded.
"Tom Christie and Duncan Innes."
He sighed deeply and stretched his arms, shifting his shoulders as though to ease the fit of his shirt, though he wore a loose nightshirt. Then he raised one hand and turned it to and fro, frowning at his wrist in the light.
"That's odd," he said,
sounding faintly surprised. "What is?"
"The marks. They're gone."
"Marks? From the irons?" He nodded, examining both his wrists in bemusement. The skin was fair, weathered to a pale gold, but otherwise unblemished.
"I had them for years, from the chafing, I never noticed that they'd gone."
I set a hand on his wrist, rubbing my thumb gently over the pulse where his radial artery crossed the bone.
"You didn't have them when I found you in Edinburgh, Jamie. They've been gone a long time."
He looked down at his arms and shook his head, as though unable to believe it.
"Aye," he said softly. "Well, so has Tom Christie."
Part 9. A Dangerous Business. Chapter 96. Oram. It was quiet in the house. Mr. Weems had gone to the gristmill, taking Lizzie and Mrs. Bug with him, and it was too late in the day for anyone on the ridge to come visiting. Everyone would be at their chores, seeing that the beasts were fed and bedded down, wood and water fetched, the fires built up for supper. My own beast was already fed and bedded. Adso, perched in a somnolent ball in a patch of late sun on the window ledge, feet tucked up and eyes closed in an ecstasy of repletion. My contribution to the supper, a dish Fergus referred to elegantly as lapin aux chanterelles, known as rabbit stew to the vulgar among us, had been burbling cheerfully away in the cauldron since early morning, and needed no attention from me. As for sweeping the floor, polishing the windows, dusting, and general drudgery of that sort, well, if women's work was never done, why trouble about how much of it wasn't being accomplished at any given moment? I fetched down ink and pen from the cupboard and the big black cloth-bound casebook, then settled myself to share Adzo's son. I wrote up a careful description of the growth on little Geordie Chisholm's ear, which would bear watching, and added the most recent measurements I had taken of Tom Christie's left hand. Christy did suffer from arthritis in both hands and had a slight degree of clawing in the fingers. Having observed him closely at dinner, though, I was nearly sure that what I was seeing in the left hand wasn't arthritis, but Dupuytren's contracture, an odd hook-like drawing in of the ring and little fingers toward the palm of the hand, caused by the shortening of the palmar aponeurosis. Ordinarily, I should have been in no doubt, but Christie's hands were so heavily calloused from years of labour that I couldn't feel the characteristic nodule at the base of the ring finger. The finger had felt wrong to me, though, when I'd first looked at the hand, in the course of stitching a gash across the heel of it, and I'd been checking it whenever I caught sight of Tom Christie and could persuade him to let me look at it, which wasn't often. In spite of Jamie's apprehensions, the Christies had been ideal tenants so far, living quietly and keeping largely to themselves, aside from Thomas Christie's schoolmastering, at which he appeared to be strict but effective. I became aware of a looming presence just behind my head. The sunbeam had moved, and Adso with it. "Don't even think of it, Cat," I said. A rumbling purr of anticipation started up in the vicinity of my left ear, and a large paw reached out and delicately patted the top of my head. "Oh, all right," I said, resigned. No choice, really, unless I wanted to get up and go right somewhere else. "Have it your way." Adso couldn't resist hair, anyone's hair, whether attached to a head or not. Fortunately, Major MacDonald had been the only person reckless enough to sit down within Adso's reach while wearing a wig, and after all, I had got it back, though it meant crawling under the house where Adso had retired with his prey. No one else dared snatch it from his jaws. The Major had been rather austere about the incident, and while it hadn't stopped him coming round to see Jamie now and then, he no longer removed his hat on such visits, but sat drinking chicory coffee at the kitchen table, his tricorn fixed firmly on his head, and both eyes fixed firmly on Adso, monitoring the cat's whereabouts. I relaxed a bit, not quite purring myself, but feeling quite mellow. It was rather soothing to have the cat knead and comb with his half-sheathed claws, pausing now and then in his delicate grooming to rub his face lovingly against my head. It was only really dangerous if he'd been in the catnip, but that was safely locked up. Eyes half closed, I contemplated the minor complication of describing Dupuytren's contracture without calling it that. Baron Dupuytren not having been born yet. Well, a picture was worth 1,000 words, and I thought I could produce a competent line drawing at least. I did my best, meanwhile wondering how I was to induce Thomas Christie to let me operate on the hand. It was a fairly quick and simple procedure, but given the lack of anaesthesia and the fact that Christie was a strict Presbyterian and a teetotaler, perhaps Jamie could sit on his chest, Roger on his legs. If Brianna held his wrist tightly... I gave up the problem for a moment, yawning drowsily. The drowsiness disappeared abruptly as a 3-inch yellow dragonfly came whirring in through the open window with a noise like a small helicopter. Adso sailed through the air after it, leaving my hair in wild disarray and my ribbon, which he appeared to have been quietly chewing, hanging wet and mangled behind my left ear. I removed this object with mild distaste, laid it on the sill to dry, and flipped back a few pages, admiring the neat drawing I had done of Jamie's snake bite and of Brianna's rattlesnake hypodermic. The leg, to my amazement, had healed cleanly and well, and while there had been a good bit of tissue sloughing, the maggots had dealt with that so effectively that the only permanent traces were 2 small depressions in the skin where the original fang marks had been, and a thin, straight scar across the calf where I had made an incision for debridement and maggot placement. Jamie had a slight limp still, but I thought this would cure itself in time. Humming in a satisfied sort of way, I flipped back further, idly browsing through the last few pages of Daniel Rawling's notes. Josephus Howard, chief complaint being a fistula of the rectum, this of so long a standing as to have become badly abscessed, together with an advanced case of piles. Treated with a decoction of ale hoof, mixed with burnt alum, and small amount of honey, this boiled together with juice of marigold. A later note on the same page, dated a month later, referred to the efficacy of this compound, with illustrations of the condition of the patient before and after administration. I raised a brow at the drawings. Rawlings was no more an artist than I was, but had succeeded in capturing, to a remarkable degree, the intrinsic discomfort of the condition. I tapped the quill against my mouth, thinking, then added a careful note in the margin to the effect that a diet rich in fibrous vegetables should be recommended as an adjunct to this treatment, useful also in preventing both constipation and the more serious complications thereof. Nothing like a little object lesson. I wiped the quill, laid it down, and turned the page, wondering whether ale hoof was a plant, and if so, which one, or a superative condition of horses' feet. I could hear Jamie rustling about in his study. I'd go ask him in a moment. I nearly missed it. It had been jotted on the back of the page containing the drawing of Mr. Howard's fistula, evidently added as a casual afterthought on the day's activities. Have spoke with Mr. Hector Cameron of River Run, who begs me come examine his wife's eyes, her sight being sadly affected. It is a far distance to his plantation, but he will send a horse. That bit overcame the soporific atmosphere of the afternoon at once. Fascinated, I sat up and turned the page, looking to see whether the doctor had in fact examined Jocasta. I had, with some difficulty, persuaded her to allow me to examine her eyes once, and I was curious as to Rawlings' conclusions. Without an ophthalmoscope, there was no way of making sure of the cause of her blindness, but I had strong suspicions, and I could at least rule out such things as cataracts and diabetes with a fair amount of certainty. I wondered whether Rawlings had seen anything I had missed, or whether her condition had changed noticeably since he had seen her. Bled the smith of a pint, purged his wife with senna oil, 10 minims, and administered 3 minims of same to the cat, gratis, I having observed a swarming of worms in the animal's stool. I smiled at that. However crude his methods, Daniel Rawlings was a good doctor. I wondered once again what had happened to him, and whether I should ever get the chance to meet him. I had the rather sad feeling that I should not. I couldn't imagine a doctor not returning somehow to claim such beautiful instruments as his, if he was in any condition to do so. Under the prodding of my curiosity, Jamie had obligingly made inquiries, but with no results. Daniel Rawlings had set out for Virginia, leaving his box of instruments behind, and had promptly vanished into thin air. Another page, another patient, bleeding, purging, lancing of boils, removal of an infected nail, drawing of an abscessed tooth, cautery of a persistent sore on a woman's leg. Rawlings had found plenty of business in Cross Creek. Had he ever made it as far as River Run, though? Yes, there it was, a week later and several pages on. Reached River Run after a dire journey, wind and rain fit to sink a ship, and the road washed away entirely in places, so was obliged to ride cross-country, lashed by hail, mud to the eyebrows. Had set out at dawn with Mr. Cameron's black servant, who brought a horse for me, did not reach sanctuary till well past dark, exhausted and starving. Made welcome by Mr. Cameron, who gave me brandy. Having gone to the expense of procuring a doctor, Hector Cameron had evidently decided to make the most of the opportunity, and had had Rawlings examine all the slaves and servants as well as the master of the house himself. Aged 73, of middling height, broad-shouldered but somewhat bowed in stature, Rawlings had written of Hector, with hands so gnarled by rheumatism as to make the handling of any implement more subtle than a spoon impossible. Otherwise, is well preserved, very vigorous in his age. Complains of rising in the night, painful micturition. I'm inclined to suspect a prurient distemper of the bladder, rather than stone or chronic disease of the inward male parts, as the complaint is recurrent, but not of long standing on any occasion of its evidence, 2 weeks being the average duration of each attack, and accompanied by burning in the male organ. a low fever, tenderness upon palpation of the lower abdomen, and a black urine, smelling strongly, incline me further to this belief. The household, being possessed of a good quantity of dried cranberries, have prescribed a decoction, the inspissated juice to be drunk thrice daily, a cupful at a time. Also recommend infusion of cleavers, drunk morning and evening for its cooling effect, and in case of there being gravel present in the bladder, which may aggravate this condition. I found myself nodding approvingly. I didn't always agree with Rawlings, either in terms of diagnosis or treatment, but I thought he was likely spot on this occasion. What about Jocasta, though? There she was, on the next page.
Jocasta Cameron, 64 years in age, tri-gravida, well-nourished and in good health generally, very youthful in aspect.
Tri-gravida. I paused for a moment at that matter-of-fact remark. So plain, so stark a term to stand for the bearing, let alone the loss, of three children. To have raised three children past the dangers of infancy, only to lose them all at once, and in such cruel fashion. The sun was warm, but I felt a chill on my heart thinking of it. If it was Brianna, or little Jemmy, how did a woman bear such a loss?
I had done it myself, and still had no idea. It had been a long time, and yet still, now and then, I would wake in the night, feeling a child's warm weight sleeping on my breast, her breath warm on my neck. My hand rose and touched my shoulder, curved as though the child's head lay there. I supposed that it might be easier to have lost a daughter at birth, without the years of acquaintance that would leave ragged holes in the fabric of daily life. And yet I knew Faith to the last atom of her being. There was a hole in my heart that fit her shape exactly. Perhaps it was that that had been a natural death, at least. It gave me the feeling that she was still with me in some way, was taken care of, and not alone. But to have children slain in blood, butchered in war. So many things could happen to children in this time. I returned to my perusal of her case history with a troubled mind. No sign of organic illness, nor external damage to the eyes. The white of the eye is clear, the lashes free of any matter. No tumour visible. The pupils respond normally to a light passed before them, and to shading of the light. A candle held close to one side illuminates the vitreous humour of the eye, but shows no defect therein. I note a slight clouding, indicating incipient cataract in the lens of the right eye, but this is insufficient to explain the gradual loss of sight.
I said aloud. Both Rawlings' observations and his conclusions matched mine. He briefly noted the length of time over which sight had failed, roughly 2 years, and the process of its failure, nothing abrupt, but a gradual shrinking of the field of vision. I thought it likely had taken longer. Sometimes the loss was so gradual that people didn't notice the tiny decrements at all until the sight was seriously threatened. Bits of the vision whittled away like cheese parings. Even the small remnant of sight remaining is of use only in dim light, as patient exhibits great irritation and pain when the eye is exposed to strong sunlight. I have seen this condition twice before, always in persons of some age, though not so far advanced. Gave it as my opinion that sight would soon be completely obliterated, with no amelioration possible. Fortunately, Mr. Cameron has a black servant capable of reading, whom he has given to his wife to accompany her and warn her of obstacles, likewise to read to her and apprise her of her surroundings. It had gone further than that now. The light had gone, and Jocasta was entirely blind. So, a progressive condition. That didn't tell me much. Most of them were. When had Rawlings seen her? It could be any number of conditions. Macular degeneration, tumour of the optic nerve, parasitic damage, retinitis pigmentosa, temporal arteritis. Probably not retinal detachment. That would have happened abruptly. But my own preliminary suspicion was of glaucoma. I remember Phèdre Jocasta's body servant wringing out cloths in cold tea, observing that her mistress was suffering from headache again, in a tone of voice that suggested this was a frequent occurrence, and Duncan asking me to make up a lavender pillow to ease his wife's megrims. The headaches might have nothing to do with Jocasta's eyesight, though, and I hadn't inquired at the time as to the nature of the headaches. They might be simple tension headaches or migraines, rather than the pressure band type that might, or might not, attend glaucoma. Arteritis would cause frequent headache too, after all. The frustrating thing about it was that glaucoma by itself had absolutely no predictable symptoms, save eventual blindness. It was caused by a failure of proper drainage of the fluid inside the eyeball, so that pressure inside the eye increased to the point of damage with no warning at all to the patient or her physician. But other kinds of blindness were largely symptomless as well. I was still contemplating the possibilities when I became aware that Rawlings had continued his notes on the back of the page in Latin. I blinked at that, a little surprised. I could tell he had written it as a continuation of the earlier passage. Quill writing shows a characteristic darkening and fading of words as the ink is renewed with each dip of the pen, and the shading of each passage tended to be different as different inks were used. No. This had been written at the same time as the passage on the preceding page. But why drop suddenly into Latin? Rawlings knew some Latin, plainly, which argued some degree of formal education, even if not formal medical education. But he didn't normally use it in his clinical notes, beyond the occasional word or phrase required for the formal description of some condition. Here was a page and a half of Latin, though, and written in scrupulous letters, smaller than his usual writing, as though he had thought carefully about the contents of the passage, or perhaps as though he felt secretive about it, as the Latin itself seemed to argue. I flipped back through the casebook, checking to verify my impression. No, he had written in Latin here and there, but not often, and always as he did here, as the continuation of a passage begun in English. How odd. I turned back to the passage concerning River Run, and began to try to puzzle it out. Within a sentence or two, I abandoned the effort and went to find Jamie. He was in his own study, across the hall, writing letters. Or not. The inkstand, made of a small gourd with a cork to keep the ink from drying, stood at hand, freshly filled. I could smell the woody reek of oak galls brewed with iron filings. A new turkey quill lay on the desk, trimmed to a point of such sharpness that it looked more suitable for a stabbing than writing, and a fresh sheet of paper lay on the blotter, three words, black and lonely, at its head. It took no more than a glance at his face to know what they said. "My dear sister." He looked up at me, smiled wryly, and shrugged.
"What shall I say?"
"I don't know." At sight of him, I had shut the casebook, clasping it under one arm. I came in and stood behind him, laying a hand on his shoulder. I squeezed gently, and he laid his own hand over mine for a moment, then reached to pick up the quill.
"I can't go on saying that I'm sorry."
He rolled the quill slowly to and fro between his thumb and middle finger.
"I've said it in each letter. If she was disposed to forgive me..."
If she was, Jenny would have replied by now to at least one of the letters that he sent faithfully to Lallybroch each month. "Ian's forgiven you, and the children." Missives from Jamie's brother-in-law arrived sporadically, but they did come, along with occasional notes from his namesake, young Jamie, and now and then a line from Maggie, Kitty, Michael, or Janet. But the silence from Jenny was so deafening as to drown out all other communications.
"Aye, it would be worse if..."
He trailed off, staring at the blank page. In fact, nothing could be worse than this estrangement. Jenny was closer to him, more important to him, than anyone in the world, with the possible exception of myself. I shared his bed, his life, his love, his thoughts. She had shared his heart and soul since the day he was born, until the day when he had lost her youngest son. Or so she plainly saw it. It pained me to see him go on carrying the guilt of Ian's disappearance, and I felt some small resentment toward Jenny. I understood the depth of her loss and sympathised with her grief, but still, Ian wasn't dead, so far as we knew. She alone could absolve Jamie, and surely she must know it. I pulled up a stool and sat down by him, laying the book aside. A small stack of papers lay to one side, covered with his laboured writing. It cost him dearly to write, wrong-handed, and that hand crippled, and yet he wrote stubbornly almost every evening, recording the small events of the day. Visitors to the ridge, the health of the animals, progress in building, new settlers, news from the eastern counties. He wrote it down, one word at a time, to be sent off when some visitor arrived who would take the accumulated pages away on the first stage of their precarious journey to Scotland. All the letters might not arrive at their destination, but some would. Likewise, most letters from Scotland would reach us too, if they were sent. For a time I had hoped that Jenny's letter had simply been missent, misplaced, lost somewhere in transit. But it had been too long, and I had stopped hoping. Jamie hadn't.
I thought perhaps I should send her this.
He shuffled through the stack of papers at the side of the desk and withdrew a small sheet, stained and grubby, ragged along one edge where it had been torn from a book. It was a message from Ian, the only concrete evidence we had that the boy was still alive and well. It had reached us at the gathering in November through the agency of John Quincy Myers, a mountain man who roamed the wilderness, as much at home with Indian as with settler, and more at home with deer and possum than with anyone who lived in a house. Written in clumsy Latin as a joke, the note assured us that Ian was well and happy, married to a girl in the Mohawk fashion, meaning, I thought, that he had decided to share her house, bed, and hearth, and she had decided to let him. He expected to become a father himself in the spring. And that was all. Spring had come and gone with no further word. Ian wasn't dead, but the next thing to it. The chances of us ever seeing him again were remote, and Jamie knew it. The wilderness had swallowed him. Jamie touched the ratty paper gently, tracing the round, still childish letters. He'd told Jenny what the note said, I knew, but I also knew why he hadn't sent the original before. It was the only physical link with Ian. To give it up was in some final way to relinquish him to the Mohawk.
Ave, said the note in Ian's half-formed writing. Ian salutat avunculus Jacobus.
Ian salutes his Uncle James.
Ian was more to Jamie than one of his nephews. Much as he loved all of Jenny's children, Ian was special. A foster son, like Fergus.
But unlike Fergus, a son of Jamie's blood, replacement in a way for the son he had lost.
That son wasn't dead either, but could not ever be claimed.
The world seemed suddenly full of lost children.
Yes, I said, my throat tight. I think you should send it. Jenny should have it, even if...
I coughed, reminded suddenly by the note of the casebook.
I reached for it, hoping it would distract him. Speaking of Latin, there's an odd bit in here. Could you have a look at it, perhaps?
Aye, of course.
He set Ian's note aside and took the book from me, moving it so the last of the afternoon sun fell across the page. He frowned slightly, a finger tracing the lines of writing.
Christ, the man's no more grasp of Latin grammar than you have yourself, Sassenach.
Oh, thanks. We can't all be scholars now, can we?
I moved closer, peering over his shoulder as he read.
I'd been right then. Rawlings didn't drop casually into Latin for the fun of it, or merely to show off his erudition.
An oddity, Jamie said, translating slowly as his finger moved across the page. I am awake. No, he means I was wakened, I think.
by sounds in the chamber adjoining that where I lay. I am thinking, I thought, that my patient went to make water and am risen to follow. Why should he do that, I wonder?
The patient, it's Hector Cameron, by the way, had a problem with his bladder. Rawlings would have wanted to watch him urinate to see what sort of difficulty he had, whether he had pain or blood in the urine, that sort of thing.
Jamie gave me a sidelong glance, one brow raised, then shook his head and returned to the casebook, murmuring something about the peculiar tastes of physicians.
Humu procedienti. The man proceeds.
Why does he call him the man rather than his name?
He was writing in Latin to be secret, I said,
impatient to hear what came next. If Cameron saw his name in the book, he'd be curious, I expect.
What happened?
The man goes out. Outdoors, does he mean? Or only out of his chamber? Outdoors, it must be. Goes out and I follow. He walks steadily, quickly. Why should he not? Oh, here. I am puzzled. I have given the man 12 grains of laudanum.
12 grains? Are you sure that's what he says? I leaned over Jamie's arm, peering.
But sure enough, he pointed to the entry, inscribed in clear black and white.
But that's enough laudanum to fell a horse.
Aye. 12 grains of laudanum to assist sleep, he says. No wonder the doctor was puzzled then to see Cameron scampering about the lawn in the middle of the night.
I nudged him with an elbow. Get on.
Well, he says he went to the necessary house, no doubt thinking to find Cameron, but no one was there and there wasn't any smell of... He didn't think anyone had been there recently.
You needn't be delicate on my account, I said.
I know, he said, grinning, but my own sensibilities are not quite coarsened yet, in spite of my long association with you, Sassenach.
How?
He jerked away, rubbing his arm where I had pinched him.
I lowered my brows and gave him a stare, though inwardly pleased to have lightened the mood for both of us.
Less about your sensibilities, if you please, I said, tapping my foot. Besides, you haven't got any in the first place, or you'd never have married me. Where was Cameron, then?
He scanned the page, lips silently forming words.
He doesn't ken. He prowled about the place until the butler popped out of his wee hole, thinking him a marauder of some sort, and threatened him wi' a bottle of whisky.
A formidable weapon, that, I observed, smiling at the thought of a night-capped Ulysses brandishing his implement of destruction. How do you say bottle of whisky in Latin?
Jamie gave the page a glance.
He says aqua vitae, which is doubtless as close as he could manage. It must have been whisky, though. He says the butler gave him a dram to cure the shock.
So he never found Cameron?
Aye, he did, after he left Ulysses, tucked up in his wee white bed, snoring. Next morning he asked, but Cameron didn't recall getting up in the night.
He flipped the page over with one finger and glanced at me.
Would the laudanum keep him from remembering?
It could do, I said, frowning, easily. But it's simply incredible that anyone with that much laudanum in him could have been up marching round in the first place. Unless...
I cocked a brow at him, recalling Jocasta's remarks during our discussion at River Run. Any chance your Uncle Hector was an opium eater or the like? Someone who took a great deal of laudanum by habit would have a tolerance for it and might not be really affected by Rawling's dose. Never one to be shocked by any intimation of depravity among his relatives, Jamie considered the suggestion but finally shook his head.
If so, I've heard naught of it. But then, he added logically, there's no reason anyone would tell me so.
That was true enough. If Hector Cameron had had the means to indulge in imported narcotics, and he certainly had, River Run being one of the most prosperous plantations in the area, then it would have been no one's business save his own. Still, I did think someone might have mentioned it. Jamie's mind was running on other lines.
Why would a man leave his house in dead of night to piss, Sassenach? He asked. I know Hector Cameron had a chamber pot.
I've used it myself. It had his name and the Cameron badge painted on the bottom.
Excellent question. I stared down at the page of cryptic scratchings. If Hector Cameron was having great pain or difficulty passing a kidney stone, for example, I suppose he might have gone out to avoid waking the house.
I haven't heard my uncle was an opium eater, but I haven't heard he was hour mindful of his wife or servant's convenience either,
Jamie observed rather cynically.
From all accounts, Hector Cameron was a bit of a bastard.
I laughed. No doubt that's why your aunt finds Duncan so congenial.
Adso wandered in, the remains of the dragonfly in his mouth, and sat down at my feet so I could admire his prize.
Fine, I told him with a cursory pat. Don't spoil your appetite, though. There are a lot of cockroaches in the pantry that I want you to deal with.
Ecce homo, Jamie murmured thoughtfully, tapping a finger on the casebook.
A French homo, do you think?
A what?
I stared at him.
Does it not occur to you, Sassenach, that perhaps it wasn't a Cameron that the doctor followed outside?
Not till this minute, no. I leaned forward and peered at the page. Why ought it to be anyone else, though, let alone a Frenchman?
Jamie pointed to the edge of the page, where there were a few small drawings.
Doodles, I'd thought.
The one under his finger was a fleur-de-lis.
Ecce homo, he said again, tapping it.
The doctor wasn't easy in his mind about the man he followed. That's why he didn't call him by name. If Cameron were drugged, then it was someone else who left the house that night. Yet he doesn't speak of anyone else who was present.
But he might not mention it, unless he'd examined whoever it was, I argued. He does put in personal notes, but most of this is strictly his case histories, his observations of his patients and the treatments he was administering.
But still, I frowned at the page.
A fleur-de-lis scribbled in the margin doesn't necessarily mean anything at all, let alone that there was a Frenchman there.
Save Fergus, Frenchmen weren't at all common in North Carolina. There were some French settlements south of Savannah, I knew, but that was hundreds of miles away. The fleur-de-lis could be nothing more than a random doodle. And yet Rawlings hadn't made such scribbles anywhere else in his book that I recalled. When he added drawings, they were careful and to the point, intended as a reminder to himself or as a guide to any physician who should come after him. Above the fleur-de-lis was a figure that looked rather like a triangle, with a small circle at the apex and a curved base. Below it was a sequence of letters, AU et AQ. AU, I said slowly, looking at that.
Aurum.
Gold?
Jamie glanced up at me, surprised. I nodded.
It's a scientific abbreviation for gold, yes. Aurum et aqua. Gold and water.
I suppose he means goldwasser.
Bits of gold flakes suspended in an aqueous solution. It's a remedy for arthritis. Oddly enough, it often works, though no one knows why.
Expensive, Jamie observed. Though I suppose Cameron could afford it. Perhaps he'd saved an ounce or two of his gold bars, eh?
He did say Cameron suffered from arthritis.
I frowned at the page and its cryptic marginalia. Maybe he meant to advise the use of goldwasser for the condition. But I don't know about the fleur-de-lis or that other thing. I pointed at it.
It's not the symbol for any medical treatment I know of.
To my surprise, Jamie laughed.
I shouldn't think so, Sassenach. It's a Freemason's compass.
Is it?
I blinked at it, then glanced at Jamie. Was Cameron a Mason? He shrugged, running a hand through his hair.
Jamie never spoke of his own association with the Freemasons. He had been made, as the saying went, in Ardsmuir, and beyond any secrecy imposed by membership in the society, he seldom spoke of anything that had happened between those dank stone walls.
Rawlings must have been one as well, he said, clearly reluctant to talk about Freemasonry, but unable to keep from making logical connections. Else he'd not have kent what that is.
One long finger tapped the sign of the compass. I didn't know quite what to say next, but was saved from indecision by Adso, who spit out a pair of amber wings and sprang up onto the desk in search of more hors d'oeuvre. Jamie made a grab for the inkwell with one hand and seized his new quill protectively in the other. Deprived of prey, Adso strolled to the edge of the desk and sat on the stack of Jamie's letters, tail waving gently as he pretended to admire the view. Jamie's eyes narrowed at this insolence. "Take your funny wee arse off my correspondence, beast," he said, poking at Adso with the sharp end of his quill. Adso's big green eyes widened as they fixed on the tip of the moving feather, and his shoulder blades tensed in anticipation. Jamie twiddled the quill tantalizingly, and Adso made an abortive swipe at it with one paw. I seized the cat hastily before mayhem could ensue, lifting him off the papers with a surprised and indignant meop of protest. "No, that's his toy," I said to the cat, and gave Jamie a reproving look. "Come along now. There are cockroaches to attend to." I reached for the casebook with my free hand, but to my surprise, Jamie stopped me.
"Let me keep it a bit longer, Sassenach," he said. "There's something very odd about the notion of a French Freemason wandering River Run by night. I should like to see what else Dr. Rawlings might have to say when he's speaking Latin."
"All right." I hoisted Adso, who'd begun to purr loudly in anticipation of cockroaches, to my shoulder and glanced out the window. The sun had set to a burning glow beyond the chestnut trees, and I could hear the noise of women and children in the kitchen. Mrs. Bug was starting to lay the supper, helped by Brianna and Masali. "Dinner soon," I said, and bent to kiss the top of Jamie's head where the last of the light touched his crown with fire. He smiled and touched his fingers to his lips and then to me. But he had already gone back to a perusal of the close-written pages by the time I reached the door. The single sheet, with its three black words, lay at the edge of the desk, forgotten. For the moment. Chapter 97. Conditions of the Blood. I caught a flash of brown outside the door, and Adso shot off the counter as though someone had shouted, "Fish!" The next best thing, evidently. It was Lizzie, on her way back from the dairy shed, a bowl of clotted cream in one hand, a butter dish in the other, and a large jug of milk pressed to her bosom, precariously held in place by her crossed wrists. Adso was twining round her ankles like a furry rope in obvious hopes of tripping her up and making her drop the booty. "Think again, cat," I told him, reaching to rescue the milk jug. "Oh, thank you, ma'am." Lizzie relaxed, easing her shoulders with a little sigh. "It's only I didn't want to be making two trips." She sniffed and tried to wipe her nose with a forearm, imperilling the butter. I snatched a handkerchief from my pocket and applied it, repressing the maternal impulse to say, "Now blow."
"Thank you, ma'am," she repeated, bobbing.
"Are you quite well, Lizzie?" Without waiting for an answer, I took her by the arm and towed her into my surgery, where the large windows gave me light enough to see by.
"I'm well enough, ma'am. Truly, I'm fine," she protested,
clutching the cream and butter to her as though for protection. She was pale, but Lizzie was always pale, looking as though she hadn't a corpuscle to spare. There was an odd pallid look to her skin, though, that gave me an uneasy feeling. It had been nearly a year since her last attack of malarial fever, and she did seem generally well, but... "Come here," I said, drawing her toward a pair of high stools. "Have a seat, just for a moment." Clearly unwilling, but not daring to protest, she sat down, balancing the dishes on her knees. I took them from her and, after a glance at Adso's unblinking predatory green gaze, put them in the cupboard for safekeeping. Pulse normal. Normal for Lizzie, that is. She tended always to be a trifle fast and shallow. Breathing? All right. No catching or wheezing. The lymph glands under the jaw were palpable, but that wasn't unusual. The malaria had left them permanently enlarged, like the curve of a quail's egg under the tender skin. Those in the neck were enlarged now too, though, and those I generally could not feel. I thumbed an eyelid up, peering closely at the pale grey orb that looked anxiously back. Superficially fine, though slightly bloodshot. Again, though, there was something not quite right about her eyes, though I couldn't put my finger on what